This is Sphinx Radio, exploring the enigmas of the ages and the puzzles of the present, with your host, William H. Kennedy.
Nick Redford, welcome to Sphinx Radio.
Well, thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
Now, Nick, I just read a wonderful book you wrote about NASA. Could you tell us the title and where people can acquire it on the internet?
Yeah, sure. The book's called The NASA Conspiracies, and it's published by New Page Books, available from Barnes & Noble, Borders, Amazon, all online books outlets. And it's basically a study of NASA's involvement in such issues as the face on Mars, UFO sightings by astronauts, alien encounters connected to the space program, and things like that.
It's a very fascinating book. I read it cover to cover.
Oh, thanks.
And one thing I really noticed is that you just lay out all the conspiracies and don't necessarily agree with them all, which I found very, very interesting, or disagree. You're just laying out the hard facts as you saw them. Now, is there any one of these NASA conspiracies that you personally feel is a major cover-up?
Yeah, I mean, there's actually several. I think one of the most interesting ones that I talk about in the book is an incident that occurred in Bolivia in 1978, in May of that year, when an unknown object crashed on a mountainside not too far from the Bolivian capital. And this has become, I suppose, like a Bolivian equivalent of the Roswell incident of 1947. You know, everybody, when we talk about crashed UFOs, everybody thinks of Roswell, not realizing that there have been a number of other significant and credible cases from around the world. And this particular incident in Bolivia in 1978 is significant because I actually managed to get hold of files from the under the terms of the Freedom of Information Act that demonstrated NASA's deep involvement and interest in this story. And the story basically was that some sort of 12 to 15 foot diameter egg-shaped object had plummeted to the ground from space. And NASA were immediately on the story, and they did checks and found that there no American space satellites or space materials had re-entered the atmosphere. They were also monitoring, of course, for, you know, Soviet flights and satellites that might decay in orbit, and it wasn't one of those. And it was nothing else that anybody else had placed into space. So in other words, something that looked like a metallic egg-shaped object had crashed to the ground, and no one could identify it with any nation on Earth. And what happened was that the American Embassy in Bolivia got straight onto the case immediately and started sending telexes and messages back to NASA saying, hey, you know, this is what's reportedly being found. The Bolivian military are going to return it to the capital. Do we want to get involved? And there are a lot of stories about NASA scientists being taken down there, flown down to Bolivia to study this vehicle or device to see what it was. Now, right now, you know, we only have, I think, the bare bones of the story. But the fact that we have these files that talk about NASA's interest, I think this is one of these cases that we're likely to hear more and more of as time progresses, and that may open up more details on NASA's involvement in the story.
Fascinating stuff, Nick. Now, chapter 4 of your book covers the Apollo mission that's called Flights of Fancy. What did you discover about the Apollo missions, and what is the reaction of the authorities or mainstream press been about this?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the most controversial areas leveled at NASA, you know, that the whole theory or idea that we didn't go to the moon, that the Apollo moon landings were hoaxed. Now, I mean, a whole range of books have been written on this issue suggesting that the whole Apollo program was just a sham, you know, filmed out in the desert at somewhere like Area 51. And the theory goes that when in the early 60s President Kennedy announced we were going to go to the moon before 1970, NASA came to the realization, this is the theory at least, came to the realization that the technology simply wasn't advanced enough to successfully send the astronauts to the moon and bring them back again. And so a decision was taken to fake it. That's a conventional simple terms, scenario that we didn't go to the moon. Now, as you pointed out in the introduction, what I do in the book is present the various conspiracy theories, the data from both sides of the argument, and then try and come to a conclusion. Now, with the issue of did we go to the moon, my view is that we actually did. I think this is one of the conspiracy theories that when we evaluate all the available evidence and testimony and actually look at it coherently and logically, I think the ball is in NASA's court. I do think we did go. So this is one of the conspiracy theories that I feel doesn't hold water. But I will be the very first to admit that a lot of intriguing data has been put forward. And that's the sole reason, you know, why this specific scenario and allegation continues to fly. For example, in the last Gallup poll in 1999, I think it was, no less than 18 million Americans said that they did not believe we'd be to the moon, which is, you know, an incredible
number. Amazing statistic, yeah.
Yeah, amazing statistic. So, you know, I think it's one of these areas that the subject's going to run and run and run. And I think one of the reasons why it continues to run is because I don't think NASA have actually done sort of like a forthright job in denying these claims or explaining some of the anomalies that people have picked up on that makes them believe we didn't go, sort of like anomalies in photographs and things like this. You know, when you're faced with 18 million people not believing, you know, I think what NASA should have done is sort of put out a full-length book or something explaining their complete position, rather than just kind of ignoring the issue or skirting around it, if you like. So, although, you know, I think a lot of the cases and, that I mentioned in the book do have a genuine conspiracy at their hearts, I'm one of the people, maybe one of the few in the conspiracy research field that thinks we actually did go to the moon.
Well, John Glenn is on your side. I believe he punched someone who harangued him about the moon.
That was Buzz Aldrin.
Buzz Aldrin, I'm sorry. That's my mistake. Thank you. I'm glad you're here to correct me, Nick, on the Buzz Aldrin. So don't confront him with it.
Well, hopefully, you know, he would agree with what I've written in the book anyway.
Buzz Aldrin, right. My mistake. Now, you have some other really fascinating chapters here. I mean, there's a ton to go over, but could you explain what you mean by these things called the Space Brothers? And we discussed this the last time you were on the show, but for our listeners who didn't hear that, could you give us a little rundown of that, Chapter 8?
Yeah, sure. Well, basically, the Space Brothers, everybody today, I'm sure, has heard of alien abductions and abductees, people who claim to be taken on UFOs and subjected to distress in medical experimentation, etc. But long before the abductees sort of began to surface in a few in the 1960s, but certainly, you know, it was massively elevated in the 1980s and 1990s. Back in the 1950s and late 40s, you had what were known as the contactees. And the contactees were different to the abductees because, as the name or the term suggests, they were people who claimed to have met aliens, like on a face-to-face basis, and had actual contact with them, not treated like lab rats or anything like that, but where the aliens, who eerily looked very much like us, but with heads of long blonde hair, and they became known as the Space Brothers, where they would have contact and there would allegedly be discussions about spiritual issues and why we need to lay down our atomic weapons and live in peace and harmony, if you like, with each other. So it was sort of an early form of alleged alien contact. Now, in the book, I interviewed a man who worked for a NASA contractor company many, many years ago, and he actually had an encounter out in the deserts of New Mexico with one of these beings. This is one of the weird things about the contactee stories of the Space Brothers. The people who had these experiences very often had no prior interest in UFOs, but, you know, they could just be sitting watching the TV and suddenly got this overwhelming compulsion to drive out to a remote desert location, not knowing why, but knowing that if they did, something strange was going to happen. And that's what this particular man did. He felt compelled to drive to one particular desert place in the town of Aztec, New Mexico, and which actually has a long-standing UFO legend attached to it. And he said that he met out in the desert late at night this long-haired very human-looking alien that, again, warned about atomic warfare. And afterwards, he mentioned, happened to mention it to some of his friends at NASA and the contracting company he worked for. I was later contacted by a representative of NASA and asked, you know, could he be interviewed? It wasn't like a threatening Man in Black scenario. It was just somebody from NASA said, you know, we'd like to speak to you further about this. We have a few questions and concerns. So he related his story to the man from NASA about what he'd seen or what this alleged alien entity had told him. And the story became even more surprising because the man from NASA told the eyewitness that NASA had been deeply following these stories of the Space Brothers and had come to a very interesting, albeit alternative, conclusion that these entities weren't extraterrestrial, but they were possibly representative of sort of the last vestiges of an ancient terrestrial race, a highly advanced human-type race that existed on the planet thousands of years ago that possibly destroyed itself or went on some sort of evolutionary decline. And that we essentially sort of elbowed them out of the picture, the human race, and but they still exist in small pockets around the world. And their warnings about atomic destruction are because they're fearful of the fact that they're forced to share the planet with this warlike species known as the human race. And so to protect their identities and location, they masquerade as aliens, if you like, during their meetings. So it was like a very alternative but very thought-provoking theory that NASA had come to.
Very fascinating and interesting stuff. Now, you have a chapter here on the face on face on Mars, and I was curious what you think. I've had Ken Fader on the show, and that's something he kind of like is vehemently opposed to, and even showed some pictures of Mars where you can see like Kermit the Frog and a happy face if you so look. What's your take on the face on Mars?
Well, yeah, I mean, you made a perfect point there that the face on Mars controversy certainly sort of polarizes researchers of the phenomenon into totally different camps. You know, on the one side you have the people who believe it is an ancient structure, and on the other side you have people who believe it's just like a trick of the light. Now, NASA itself doesn't avoid talking about the face on Mars, but they largely take the view that what people are seeing is kind of like the equivalent of people seeing faces in clouds. You know, it's like if you look for something, eventually you'll see it. But in saying that, my personal view is that the face does represent some sort of carved ancient structure. And I base my theories or conclusions largely on the work of a man named Matt Tonis, who back in 2004 wrote a book called After the Martian Apocalypse. And I actually interviewed Mac extensively for the book. He unfortunately passed away in 2009, but he left this long legacy of research into the face on Mars. And Mac essentially studied all the available photographs, consulted with experts in the field, and came to conclude that the face is an artificial structure, but probably carved, you know, we could be talking 100,000, quarter of a million years ago by a civilization that, you know, as we just have no idea who they were. There is evidence, for example, on Mars that, for example, what looks like evidence of shorelines, massive shorelines indicating huge lakes or oceans. And we know that there is water in abundant and in an abundant amount, particularly in the form of ice at the polar ice caps of Mars. And some of the photographs that even NASA has declassified into the public domain show what looks eerily like evidence of vegetation in some sparse areas. So it's not impossible that perhaps, you know, a million years ago, half a million years ago, Mars could have been like our planet with a rich atmosphere, vegetation, oceans, land masses, and a civilization. And that something catastrophic, you know, destroyed the atmosphere and the life. And Max speculated on a very interesting fact that not far from the face, which looks eerily kind of like the Egyptian Sphinx, there actually also appears a number of what look like ruined pyramid-type structures. And Mac wondered if sort of the last remnants of this Martian race, when their planet began to sort of spiral into destruction, may have managed to make their way to here and sort of not much seeded life, but kind of upgraded the primitive eight men that lived here at the time and, you know, helped, I guess, helped blossom some of our early civilizations that actually did build Sphinx-like structures and pyramids, you know, in South America and Egypt. And, you know, Mac ironically wondered if we are the descendants of Martians, you know, that left their world and came here, that possibly the face represents the last remnants of that ancient civilization. And I think he made a very good case for the idea that the face is artificial.
That's quite amazing, Nick, especially when you consider one of the things they're talking about doing is actually colonizing and terraforming Mars, you know, encase it in glass and grow food as our population grows. So in a sense, that could be a homecoming as opposed to a colony, which is a very kind of where science fiction and science fact meet, a wonderful thing even to think about.
Very strange,
very interesting. Now, you have a wonderful, my favorite chapter in this whole book, and I saved it for last, was about the possible sabotage of the two space shuttle disasters. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, this is a story that's very little known to most people. When in 1986 the space shuttle Challenger exploded, and Columbia exploded in 2003. Columbia exploded when it was returning to the Earth, and Challenger exploded just after takeoff from the launch pad. And both explosions became the subject of FBI investigations, and Challenger, particularly in 1986, became the subject of a huge FBI file, which I was able to get hold of by the terms of the Freedom of Information Act. Now, the official story, and I think it is the true story, is that, you know, it was purely just due to a malfunction, a catastrophic malfunction that, you know, blew the craft up and tragically killed all the astronauts. But what happened was that in the immediate wake of the explosion of Challenger, a number of people contacted the FBI to say they felt that there was some sort of sabotage involved. Now, in terms of these particular stories, what's interesting is that they came from people with quite credible backgrounds. One of them, for example, was a man who worked in the video industry of the 1980s, and who said that he felt that there was evidence of what looked like a laser-guided weapon aimed at the fuel tanker of the space shuttle, and the FBI was sufficiently concerned to go out to his home, and they basically sat down with him in his living room and asked him to, you know, show the evidence of what he thought was this sort of laser-guided weapon. And again, although NASA, you know, said, well, no, we think it's actually due to an accident, the FBI actually approached the scientific branches of the Army, Air Force, and Navy to get deep briefings on the then current state of laser-guided weapons research. I think the strangest story that the FBI certainly heard came from a woman who said that there was some sort of like a terrorist angle to the space shuttle disaster. And she was reportedly getting her information. She said it was being channeled through to her by what sounded suspiciously like almost like ethereal alien entities that knew the truth of the disaster. And they were channeling the information to her for her then to get it out to the FBI. And this sounds like a very bizarre story. What makes it even more bizarre is that no less than, I think it's 27 or 28 pages of the FBI's file on this particular saga of this woman channeling these discarnate entities about why the space shuttle was destroyed is actually still classified to this day, 25 years after the disaster occurred. So, you know, in other words, we have a very, very weird scenario where, you know, the space shuttle explodes, the FBI's hot on the trail, and all across the United States there are people coming forward with these conspiracy theories that it was, you know, sabotage, disaster, laser-guided weapons, terrorist groups, these stories about, you know, these ESP and this woman being getting channeled information. And the file now is available. It's an extensive file, about an inch thick, and tells a sort of fascinating but, you know, very odd story of, you know, what happens behind the scenes when accidents like this occur and, you know, people come out with their own theories. But to the FBI's credit, you know, they dug very deeply and prepared a sort of fascinating little known piece of NASA history, if you like.
That's really amazing, because the mainstream media didn't even mention that the FBI looked into it in any way, shape, or form.
No, you're right. And I mean, the interesting thing is that it wasn't just like the FBI were kind of addressing this issue from, you know, their headquarters in Washington. I mean, this spanned Florida, the city of Dallas. You know, that they had agents all around the United States looking at this. They had agents, as I said, going out to meet with personnel from the Army, Air Force, and Navy that were researching laser-guided weaponry. And it was a really extensive, authoritative investigation. And as you point out, you know, we didn't really hear anything about this to any large extent. It was, you know, it was all we heard was the space shuttle blew up, and then further down the line, NASA published its own report. You know, we just didn't really get to hear until now these files are available, what it was actually going on behind the scenes.
Amazing stuff. Now, I just want to give out the information once more. The title of the book is The NASA Conspiracies, and it's put out by New Page Books, 2010, and people can get it on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. And Nick, you also do a blog over at the Fate Magazine webpage. Are you still doing that?
Yes, I am. I've actually got to post some more. I've got to be quiet over Christmas with
right.
Christmas and everything else. But yes, I write for the, I blog for the Fate Magazine website, and people can find me there.
Very interesting. Well, I'd like to thank you for being on Sphinx Radio, and I highly recommend the NASA Conspiracies, and we'll have you on again concerning one of your other books as well.
All right. Well, if you're interested, we'll have a new book out in May, which is all about the history of the Men in Black mystery.
Oh, that will be fascinating. Wonderful stuff. And as you know, that goes back further than most people believe as well.
Yes, and I'll be sure to make sure that the publisher sends you a copy when it comes out.
Very good. Thank you very much, Nick, and we'll have you back again.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks a lot.
Okay, we're all set with that, okay?
Okay, great.
That was a very good interview. I'm very happy with it.
All right, perfect. Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye-bye now.
See you later, Bill. Bye.